mechanist, or I guess I can go over. So I'm currently sitting in my office, and my office has a quote by Richard Feynman's right-hand man at a think tank, W. Daniel Hillis, and a quote by Richard Feynman himself. So it's not your typical baseball place. It's got two physicist quotes on the wall. To my left is a biomechanist who was going to play baseball at University of Washington but decided not to. And then to my right is a contract engineer who works on, she's a contract engineer for electrical engineering. Her name's Chrissy, and she does awesome work. So that's what's going on right now.
So I'm gonna just go ahead and start recording here. My name is Kate Prusser. I am the host of the Lookout Landing podcast, along with my co-host, John Troopin. John, hello, how are you?
Doing well.
It's been a while since we have put together a podcast because the people have not been so interested in hearing about the Mariners lately.
With good reason.
Yep, but we've got something that we think that you are going to be interested in today, and we're speaking with Kyle Bodie of Driveline. Kyle, welcome. Thank you
Oh.
for dropping by and talking to us.
Yep, you bet. I've owed you it since Pitch Talks, so it's good to finally get it in the can.
It's true. Kyle and I were on a panel together, like not this past summer, the summer before, I guess. So, and I immediately said, need to come on the podcast and explain all the work that's being done at Driveline. So that is what we're going to have you do. Give us a little bit of the, and you yourself too have an interesting background that Levi Weaver's excellent article for the, well, it was a three-part series of articles for The Athletic, kind of delved into. The word unconventional pops up a lot with you, unorthodox, a lot of different ways I think of saying innovative, but unconventional definitely describes your background prior to getting into baseball. I mean, we have Warped Tour bassist, Magic the Gathering player, poker player, like there's mathematician, there's a lot going on, economist. Tell us about what brought you to where you are sitting now.
That's a very long story, but that's all true. I was a bassist in a band. We opened up for Hawthorne Heights, played with them a little bit, if
It was
anyone's
called
familiar.
Stand to Fall,
It
if anyone
was, yeah,
wants
I was trying to avoid
to
the
get
name.
into that.
There's not much out there, but yeah,
How
you can find our
would you describe the music of Stand to Fall?
a really bad AFI band.
Oh.
It sounded, our lead singer sounded like Davey Havoc. But that's our guitarist and our drummer were like truly extremely brilliant musicians, like really good. And then I'm a classically trained piano, violin, viola musician that made the transition to bass guitar. So I was okay. But like they were really good actual rock guitarists and drummers. So they went on to do some really, really great stuff, playing some other bands, like I believe like Somerset and a few other pretty good projects. But no, that was college and right after college. But yeah, I grew up in college. I had like nine different majors. I was studying anything that would get me out of college, basically. I started off in computer science, then computer information services, then economics, business administration. I just tried to get out. And then I eventually settled on philosophy because my college said if you took 27 credits of anything in philosophy, you can graduate. So, yeah. Oh, it wasn't a rigorous philosophy either, of course. There are some very rigorous philosophy undergrads, I'm sure. This was not one of them. But I ended up dropping out. I moved to Costa Rica for a little bit. I worked at PokerStars. I got into kind of gambling as a profession. Moved to Seattle about 13 years ago now. And kind of as something to do, I started coaching Little League. And I wanted, if I was going to coach baseball, I played sports growing up. Football, tennis was my main sport. Baseball, hockey, played a lot of sports growing up. So if I was going to coach, I wanted to actually take a little bit more of a scientific approach. So I read a lot of medical journals. I bought tons of books on on baseball practices and baseball in general. And it just struck me like none of these texts and none of these papers are written from a scientific point of view. Like no one knows, everyone is writing stuff. It's like the internet in general. People just write shit and they have no idea if it's true. You know, they just state it like it is true. And so coming from an economist and coming from just like a scientific background, my father worked at NASA and was an electrical engineer. Just a lot of it was requiring proof of, is it true? Like, what is your level of certainty? Mm-hmm. And that's just how I always approach things. And so when I read a lot of stuff in sports, I was just like, why does no one take this approach? And I read Moneyball years after it was published. And so while I
what year are we talking about for... So this is 13 years ago?
Yeah, so this was probably 05. Yeah, 05, 06. So, like, I read Moneyball, you know, years after it was published. And the statistical stuff was interesting, but I kind of also correctly intuited that that was probably saturated at this point. You know, there's probably plenty of analysts who have picked the low-hanging fruit. I'm not that strong of a mathematician. So what really interested me was the chapter on like Scott Hatterberg. So it was like, instead of finding that, like shouldn't we like try to develop that, right? Aren't there just tons of untapped Scott Hatterbergs everywhere on the hitting side, pitching side, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. How do we develop that? And that's really kind of what led me to where I'm at now, like that type of thing.
Interesting. When you say you were coaching Little League, like what age were we talking? Like you have a bunch of 9-year-olds and you're trying to like hack the kinetic chain of a 9-year-old, or what's the scenario there?
No, I really have low tolerance for young kids, including my own. So I chose to coach 13 and 14-year-olds, like juniors. So right before high school, that's kind of the age I was working with.
So you're looking at kids who aren't quite at the point where, and especially with, you know, how prospects are getting younger and younger all the time, you know, you're not working with kids who are maybe on that track yet, but kids who are just before maybe the potential track of like varsity baseball, getting noticed by scouts, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, just before they start high school. And these are Little League players, so they're not, you know, like the top of the food chain or anything.
Go ahead, John.
Well, I guess I was curious, you know, having worked with that group, and now you're obviously working with, you know, college-age kids, you know, pros at all levels. How do you treat, you know, people that are coming in, maybe in high school or early in college, versus guys who are in the pros or have even already made it to the majors, that might have a very different sort of assessment of themselves? I mean how do you sort of manage that, you know, personality, and in addition to obviously the physical side that might be very vastly different?
Yeah, you have two things, right? There's the emotional maturity and readiness level of someone who's 25, especially if they've already had success at the pro level. Yeah, if they're a pro, they're successful, you know, in their mind at least. And so also there's the physical thing, right? If they're 25 and they've done something they're one way their whole life, it's hard to really kind of do something different, right? So physically, from a motor patterning perspective, you're not trying to teach that person a ton of different things. In fact, Mariner, a very short-term beloved Mariner pitcher was here today, Emilio Pagan.
And so for
like,
Emilio.
Yeah, so like Emilio was here with Lou Trevino, and then some of the, you know, these are in town, obviously. So people that we had worked with. And so for Emilio, he made a comment to one of the front office members with Seattle when they were asking him about like the weighted ball program, you know, why he had done it, like what, you know, what were the benefits. And Emilio was like, I just repeated AA for the third time. And I'm just not trying to be in Jackson anymore, you know. And he's
fair
like,
enough.
So, you know, so he made the comment. He's like, there's tons of pitchers in the minors that I've played with, and just broadly speaking, theoretically, that if they just, you know, did something different, whatever it was, and it had opened up their mind, they'd probably be a lot better. You know, but so that requires someone like Emilio to recognize that they need to improve and to do something. And it's our job to make it palatable, right? It's our job to not bruise their ego and to tell them they suck. It's to kind of, how do we, because they don't suck, right? So it's trying to get them something that's going to work for them on the lowest level. And so then to go all the way down to like 13 and 14, these, you know, they're kids, they're not fully formed, they can't train as hard as older people, you know, they're not reaching their physical maturity, they have puberty they're dealing with, emotional issues, right, a family, and that kind of thing. So like for them, it's more about how do you build good habits that are going to last, and then layer it slowly over time. And then they, and then you can do more things, like you can rework their delivery. You can do more invasive things that you would never do with someone like Emilio, because he just doesn't need it, right? He's a successful enough double-A pitcher, so that wouldn't be an appropriate way to go about it.
Right, so it's about engineering. So that's interesting, because I was reading Levi's Athletic article, and in part three, he deals with some of the critiques that have been leveled against Driveline, and one scout, speaking on the condition of anonymity, of course, says it's a cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all approach, which has not been my understanding of Driveline, but I wanted to maybe get your response to that quote.
Sure. I think so. I've come full circle. I used to get really mad online at stuff like that. But the more that I think about it, you know, like if I'm a scout, put myself in that situation, that guy's probably older, almost certainly, right? He's in his 40s or 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And he has seen it all, right? He's seen Tom House. He's seen the rise of Tom House. Obviously, if, you know, there's a good chance that scout was with Texas, right? Because, like, it's Levi, right? So, like, there's a good... So he's seen the rise of Tom House. He's seen Ron Wolforth. He's seen all these gimmicks and tons of things making ridiculous marketing promises. And so then what is the difference between all of that that he has seen and Driveline baseball? You know, what's the difference between that? And to him, nothing, right? There's right. nothing different between any of that, right? And so I don't blame him necessarily, because while he's wrong, his experience is not ridiculous. Like the conclusion that he has drawn, he's not going to spend a ton of time like researching on drivelinebaseball.com. He's just not going to do it, right? So is that his fault? Sure. Right, but it's our job, like it's our job to realize that that's the system that we're working within,
right?
And just understand that like the rate of change is going to be slow as a result. And instead of just getting angry about it, how do we educate people in the best way possible? How we can do it? So it's definitely not a one size fits all. You know, we just have a person who has a master's degree in biomechanics just walk into the room, and he's one of our biomechanists, and they. They work with all of our guys. We have, I think, 450 or so assessments now at this time, which we, you know, use machine learning to take a look at and say, like, what are the trends and what actually dictates injury and performance? What makes guys get better? And instead of cookie-cuttering things, honestly, to use his phrases, you know, we take this incredible amount of data that we collect using a ton of different tools, and we tailor training programs around that, which is what makes us different, because a lot of biomechanics labs are disconnected from the training side. You know, you get a report, here's all the things, you may get hurt if you do these things, you should change these things. And if you give that report to someone like Emilio, he's going to be like, awesome, so how do I make these changes? And then the biomechanist is going to be like, I don't know, you know, like, you know, I don't know what to do, you know, just don't do those things. It's like, well, that's not really how that works. So that's the difference that we are. And I think, you know, I certainly don't think we're a cookie cutter, but I also, all of that is hard for someone to understand if they come from a background of seeing the industry's already been poisoned, the well has already been poisoned, and that's really just something we have to deal with. It's not fair, but it's just kind of life.
So how does that translate then to, I guess, like, the response that you mentioned of Pagan, of sort of having to answer questions about why are you doing this sort of different thing? You know, and I know you've spoken on occasion about this, but... You know, some organizations obviously are more encouraging of, you know, the type of training that you guys do. But, I mean, is it really just that there are a lot of organizations that still are kind of tepid or are just not really encouraging of, you know, sort of finding new training methods? Like, are they not equipped? Like, what do you see as sort of what holds organizations back? I mean, is it really just that there are a ton of those guys like that scout that are peppered throughout organizations still?
Yeah, you have teams like the biggest offenders are probably like the Marlins and the Reds, who are just, you know, they outright ban.
Oh, wow. I'm really surprised that two organizations with such track histories of success like that are hostile to these.
Right. Yeah, they take a very strong anti-analytics stance, right? And then that's always going to blend over to everything else they do, right? So that's a big part of that. Those two teams are just really against anything progressive on the training side, whether it's pitching or hitting, or it doesn't really matter what. But then you have teams that I think that have really built built a really good minor league system around it, of different thinking. Like the Cleveland Indians are probably the best example of that, because years ago they brought in, they did it the right way in my opinion. You know, they defined a 3 to 4 year time period where who's going to own the product, right? And it goes beyond the tool. It doesn't matter what it is. Yeah, they use weighted balls and different types of training and weightlifting and things that are pretty. I think they're unique, and I think that's a big competitive advantage for them. But it's not about that, right? That's the mistake that the teams make. Like, they're like, what is the magic fairy dust that makes them better? You know, it's more about, like, what is the process that did it? Who owns the product? Who's responsible for it? Who reports? Is the front office stable, right? The Cleveland Indians front office has had unparalleled stability, you know, compared to any other organization, right, over the last 40 years, right? So that's a huge part of it. And that's the big thing. You start to realize it's a systems problem. And then you have teams that are accepting of it, that are like totally cool with having guys around, but they don't really they don't support it. You know, they don't have their own programs, and that would be teams like the Mariners, the Brewers, a couple other teams that are like, okay, you know, we don't care, we just want output. But then you have some teams that are openly hostile, and it's a shrinking number for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, but they're still out there for sure. I would say that the teams that are against it, there are some of them that are like virulently like becoming more and more anti-analytic, anti-progressive, internally. Like they're like intensifying their hatred for it.
They're like doubling down on it.
Yeah.
As they see everyone else going this one way, they're like, "Ah, right. We're going to be clever and zig where everyone else is zagging."
Yeah, and I think it's a totally logical strategy. It's the wrong one, but it's a logical one, right? Because like there's a great story about the Apple, about BlackBerry engineers. Like when the BlackBerry engineers saw the iPhone for the first time. The first iPhone is a good example of like no one knew they needed this until they saw it, right? And then when you saw the iPhone, you're like, that's what a phone should look like, right? Like everyone knew it as soon as you saw it, but you could never come up with it yourself. So the minute the BlackBerry people saw the engineers, they weren't stupid. They saw it. They're like, oh shit, you know, like to get BlackBerry to look like that is going to take 2 to 3 years because we haven't put any thought into it. So instead of that, let's take the long shot that, like, let's double down that people really want a physical keyboard, that BlackBerry Messenger is the way to go, really just push that. And then I think that's a very logical strategy because they know they're going to lose the war if it pivot, so you have to try something else. And I think that's probably where the Marlins are at and the Reds. So I understand. It's like an extinction burst reaction, you know. So, yeah, that's kind of where I see it.
Yeah. I wanted to ask earlier when we were talking with the scout who's, you know, this anonymous figure, but we said maybe based in Texas, like maybe based somewhere in the broad part of the country that's not the Seattle area, right? Which is not typically, I think, known as a baseball hotbed. Certainly we have produced MLB players from the area. Certainly we have, you know, there's baseball here, but it's not your California, it's not your Texas, it's not your Florida. Like it's not maybe... Do you ever feel like geographical isolation plays a role in perception of driveline?
I think it does. It plays, it's a negative and a positive in some ways. We've had the opportunity internally to move this business to Phoenix. When it was brought up, our employees were pretty against it, which I thought was surprising because most of our company, including myself and my partner, are not from Seattle. We're the transplants that are ruining your city, so my fault. But they like it here. You know, they love the city, and so they want to stay here. So the positives are it's kind of an interesting destination to come to. You know, you can't just get it anywhere. And because it's kind of remote, at the early parts of this company, it self-selected the right pros, right? It was hard to get to.
Right.
The weather sucks in the winter, so, like, it only attracts the people that really want to do it. So then as a result, you get to build your brand on people that are really good ambassadors. The negatives are it's expensive. And getting more expensive by the day, real estate. And it's stuff that we really worry about, honestly. I think with the internet and things, I think it's just the natural. I don't think the geographic isolation has much to play with perception of our company because we're on the road so much and doing a good job being in spring training camps and talking to people and getting our message out. Because on the college side, we dominate amateur baseball with our products and services are in use widely in NCAA.
Right. I know that Mercyhurst, that's sort of where Dan Altavilla...
Just came by the other day, actually, and dropped off a jersey. So it was nice.
Nice.
Okay. Yeah, he threw good. He was healthy, threw off the mound. He looks great. Yeah.
Good for him.
On track for next year, then, we hope.
Yeah, definitely. I think so.
Yeah, I know that Mercyhurst to me is a really interesting example, because here's a small school, Division II. I wouldn't know Mercyhurst except that my mom happened to go there because she grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania, and it was like the college. When she went there, it was an all-girls school. So just through their head coach, whose name is escaping me right now, Joe,
I forget. I'm going to get torched by Dan on this one here.
Well, I'll keep talking and let you covertly look it up and pretend like you just had a great stroke of inspiration. He's been really innovative, I think, in using a program that's, you know, a cold weather state baseball, obviously, Division II, kind of small. And he's built it into this D2 powerhouse primarily through breeding a really great culture, which you can do anywhere, right? And also through just having this kind of innovative mindset. And part of that is reaching into, like, electrostim machines and into, like, what are the new breakthroughs in training? What are the new things that are just being really open to that innovation? So that's, I think, where you see Driveline kind of entering in. Do you have any other experiences like that? Like, what are of the school? I know that Oregon State uses Driveline heavily.
So
obviously programs that are producing successful major leaguers who are carrying this into the big leagues. What does that look like across college baseball? Are we talking like, are there geographical areas of concentration? How has Driveline spread through NCAA? That's my question.
Yeah, it's gone from Oregon State really was like the first program that took a chance on us to go from, you know, 2012, I believe, was the first big program. You know, there were some that were using it sporadically, but it was the first one to say, like, we want to plan. How do we roll this out? And I've told the story before, but I got there. Coach Nate Yeske asked me to come down. I visited the next week. He said, we're going to roll this out with redshirt and freshmen and just kind of progress it slowly. And I said, yeah, that sounds responsible. And I got there and I went into a room, and it was Jace Fry, who's now closing for the White Sox. Ben Wetzler, who's having a great resurgent year after being released by the Marlins and now with the Dodgers. It's weird. You know, he's been really, really good for them. And Andrew Moore. Mm-hmm. And then a couple others. And then after kind of talking to them a little bit, I turned to Nate and there was a break. And I told Nate, I'm like, I know who these are. I know who these players are. Like, these are not redshirt freshmen. Like, it's the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday starters. And, like, if this goes bad, like, we're fucked, you know? Like, and Nate's like, we can win the Pac-12, you know, like, that's fine. It's not that hard. Like, we can compete. He's like, what I see is, like, we make the super regionals or whatever, and we're going to lose to Louisville, Vanderbilt. We don't have the arms, you know, and we're not going to be able to recruit that type of arm. You know, we're not going to be able to get the best players that they get. It's just not going to happen. You know, we're certainly going to try our asses off, but we're not going to get the guy that should have been a first overall or whatever. You know, like the Walker Buellers, the Carson Fulmers aren't coming here, you know, so we have to develop it. And he's like, and there's no way that Vanderbilt went from being a joke of a program, which they were, to the best in college baseball purely by recruiting and by luck, you know. He's like, there was some development, and so I want to get ahead of that. And so then, fortunately, as soon as, you know, baseball is such a copycat sport in a lot of ways, as soon as Oregon State started seeing some success, everyone else wanted a piece. You know, everyone is just waiting for someone else to be the first in baseball. Right. And that's pro ball and that's college. So that's kind of how it spread to them. Mercyhurst has been using stuff for much longer than we've even existed, honestly. Mm-hmm. So they just kind of adopted our stuff because it was a little bit better fit for them. But Mercyhurst, Oregon State, Vanderbilt, North Carolina, Coastal Carolina, Santa Barbara, tons, you know, lots of schools.
I mean, that's sort of a fascinating, like, you know, not like it was a gigantic leap of faith necessarily, but I mean, that, you know, that's a program that, like, won the, you know, NCAA tournament in, like, you know, like 5 years before and, like, had been in the, and, you know, in the tournament almost every year, right? I mean, like, that's a, like, top, I mean, obviously, as you said, not necessarily, like, top level, but, like, a consistently strong program that said, all right, we're good, but and we could easily get by on staying the same, but, you know, instead said, we want to continue getting better, we want to look and find something to improve. I mean, that's a really remarkable sort of fit there.
Yeah, it's it speaks to Nate, and Nate, it's a compound that Nate had just won Pitching Coach of the Year prior.
Wow.
So there was no,
no reason to do anything different, right? Matt Boyd had had a huge breakout year that year, the year prior in 11. Andrew Moore won, I think, 12 games as a freshman. Chase Fry was coming off Tommy John surgery and threw a no-hitter against Trevor Bauer. And Wetzler was really good, too. So it's like, man, they had, like, just tons of great players on that team. So why get better? And Nate's like, why not? You know, because his whole entire – he's like, that's what got me here, this attitude. You know, it's not what I've done. It's the attitude, which I think he correctly understood that that's the way to go. So he's been, you know, a great friend of mine for a long time and great coach. Obviously, he won pitching coach of the year again in 2017. And so he's just done – he's been a great supporter of our program for sure. But Nate is a perfect example of someone who rolls it out. It's the system and the product and, like, accountability is more important than just, like, giving people weighted balls and telling them to go throw them. It's not that simple. You know,
yeah, that's, like, the distillation of Driveline, right, is people, oh, the weighted balls thing, the weighted balls thing. Is that the biggest misunderstanding about your program that it's just about that, or your the biggest misunderstanding about Driveline that it's just weighted balls?
It is, but it's one that we deserve. You know, I think so, because, well, we made our name on it, right? People, I think with people, there's a lag time in understanding anything, right? So when I was writing, you know, for the Hardball Times and then SB Nation, you know, and when I was first coming up, the attitude was that you couldn't develop velocity. Like, it just couldn't be done. You couldn't get guys to
God-given or
right, and, like, and weighted balls are certainly not going to get it done either. Right, so then, even though all the research, there were tons of research papers showing that did work. It was not a guess. There were tons of research papers showing that this was effective specifically in baseball. And then if you want to take it to other throwing sports, then you have decades of research showing that this type of stuff works for anything, for javelin, any type of throwing training program. People have been using overload, underload objects since 1930s in an organized way in sport. And so it was very odd to me that no one thought it was useful. So then when we proved that it would work, you have to fight that battle. Then we win that battle, and then it shifts to, well, they work, but they don't work to develop pitching velocity. All they're doing is throwing the ball. And then we show that, you know, pitchers can develop. All of a sudden, you know, Trevor Bauer goes to throwing from 88 to 91 when he was hurt all the way back up to 99 miles per hour. And they go, oh, yeah, well, you know, he's going to hurt himself or whatever. And then obviously Trevor hasn't been hurt outside of a line drive to the shin. And then we've, you know, we've conducted a ton of research and built a biomechanics lab to show that there's really not a lot of injury markers that show that this stuff is really dangerous. You know, I'm open to the idea that these things might be dangerous or whatever. You know, weighted balls don't define who we are. It's about scientific thinking and finding out what it is. I think people come to the conclusion that Driveline was based around selling weighted baseballs, and, like, I found weighted baseballs, therefore I base my business off using weighted baseballs. And the opposite is actually true. You know, I did not like weighted baseballs for a long time. I thought they were stupid, just like everyone else. But I tested them, and they work, so then we use them. And that's always been the foundation of who we are. But because we chose weighted baseballs first and we had to fight that war, people remember us for that forever. And that's something you live with. That's just business.
Right.
So I don't think it's an unfair characterization. I just think that I would just hope that people would do a little bit more research on us if they were interested. You know, there's just tons of people who make throwaway comments, and there's nothing we can do about that. But if people do enough, if people want to do enough in-depth research and unbiased work, I think the resources are out there to find out who we really are, and that's the best I can do.
There are a lot of people, well, the detractors of Driveline claim that. I have not yet seen any kind of evidence backing these claims that Driveline actually leads to more pitcher injuries. It doesn't prevent injury, that there's harm, active harm being done at the facility. Again, these are claims that are made without evidence, but I wonder what it is, if you have any reactions to that, because I know data rules all at Driveline. So obviously, clearly, you would reject these assertions, but where do you think they come from? Why is that the thing that, for all the thing, I mean, people could say it doesn't make pitchers necessarily all that more effective. Why do you think they say that their main critique is, no, it actually does injure pitchers, and they're actually just covering it up, and no, I don't have any evidence for this, but this is what I believe.
Yeah, to address the facts of the assertion, one, we track injury rate here, and basically the way that we do it is who's gotten hurt at the facility actively training here. The type of athlete that we include in the sample are athletes that are training here, and then athletes after they have trained here for 365 days after they've left. So then we're like, we're accountable for a year after they've left here. And then if they never return, then, you know, then we kind of drop them out of the sample. But if they keep returning every year, then obviously this is a perpetual sample of people, which describes a lot of the people we have. And then of that, if you take the national average of incidences of arm injuries broadly and like surgical interventions to the shoulder and elbow at the professional and the college level, we fall well under the average, like significantly under the average of both, statistically significant in both cases. So I can say from an empirical point, we are, our players, the players who train here, suffer injury at a much lower rate than the general population. Now, that could be because we're doing something right. It could be the fact that the players who train here are predisposed to actually caring, and they're not elsewhere. So it's true. So it's a
self-selected
multivariate
sample in some
sure
ways.
So we probably have some, I think the evidence is clear enough to suggest that we probably do something right. You know, we're certainly, there's no evidence to suggest that we're doing something wrong, that's for sure. But we're probably doing something right. And then the other part is that we own up to the injuries that occur here. So people have been injured here. People have torn their shoulder here. And by here, I mean literally in the facility, it's happened. Mm-hmm. And my policy is one of, I want to protect the athletes. So, you know, we are not going to put their injuries on blast if they're not, you know, going to come out and say it themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not one of those people. But we do own it. You know, it's like, I'm not going to hide from it. There are pitching coaches out there, there's tons of them that say no injury has ever occurred because of my program. It's just, well, first of all, that's probably either A, you have no one, or B, like there's only three things can be true there. One, A, you have insufficient people. Two, you have just all terrible pitchers who aren't generating enough arm speed that it matters. Or C, you're lying, you know? And that's not us. You know, people have gotten hurt. We tell them, we're like, this is not miracle working here. You know, here's all the data, and like you are incurring a risk, and potentially by training here, you're incurring a larger risk. There's no way to know. I don't think that you are. The data seems to suggest that you're not. But you have to be okay with the concept of it, and professional athletes by and large are. So by being radically open, you have one faction of people who uses that against you, right? They're like, oh, look at this. He says that so and so had surgery here, and this guy got a lot worse, and he couldn't get these guys better. And that's all true. You know, if you stick to the facts, I'm willing to admit that those things are true. But, you know, then they don't want to turn and then give us credit for the people that we have helped. So that's it's always a kind of a dual sword. You know, it is what it is. I can only focus on – I've gone past caring about that in some sense. That doesn't – don't get me wrong. I get annoyed about it online sometimes. But I've gone from – I've said this before. I've gone from like trying to convince people that this is right, whether it's the front office of any team, like this is the way that we should train players, like this is the system that works. I've gone past that. At this point, I don't care. Like I'm very convinced. Like we're right. Like our path, the path that we're developing players, is correct. We're generating much better results than most of Major League Baseball, and so as a result, like if you can look at all this data and honestly say that we suck at our jobs, then fine. Then let's compete. This is America. Let's compete on business. Like if you're so much better of a pitching coach, if you're so much better of a provider, then you're just going to crush me in the marketplace. And I look forward to it, you know, but I like our chances is kind of how I put it.
I'm curious a little bit about, you know, in discussing that sort of self-selective group, you know, especially when you have, you know, off-season training and you have people coming to you, individually saying, you know, like Emilio Pagan presumably saying, like, I don't want to go 3 years in Jackson, Tennessee. You know, have you had, you know, I mean, obviously not everyone works out or not everyone can hack it or sticks with it. But, you know, how often are there circumstances where either teams try and send guys to you or individual players come to you and not because necessarily your program isn't working, but they how often is there that clash of ego, or just a clash of not being willing to stick with it enough, a factor? Because I, you know, especially as I'm interested in how a team might implement, you know, like Cleveland has, might implement this sort of program on a collective buy-in basis, you know, how, what have there been instances where you specifically have seen people really struggle and really fall flat trying to get involved in this?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the way to approach that, the Indians, and I'll speak to the Dodgers. We did kind of a onboarding with the Dodgers, like how the Dodgers, when Gabe Kapler was there, how can we jumpstart this? You know, Gabe knew that he wanted to do it with the Dodgers. So can we bring Driveline in to kickstart it and then like push Driveline to the curb, and then it'll be our thing, and then we'll just buy equipment. And I say that with love. I love Gabe. Okay. And but that was clear from the outset.
Okay. Know,
he's like, this is not going to be an ongoing relationship. There was an idea that it might be, but then as we got into it deeper, it's like for both parties, it doesn't make sense. For one main reason, right? Like, if the pitching coach and Kyle Bodie are standing in Rancho Cucamonga and they identify with Kyle as the guy that got them better, but not the pitching coach, this is a real problem of authority.
Sure.
Because I'm not there every day. And so the pitching coach needs to be the final authority, period. I agree with that. So as a result, it's like, how do we bring these people in for their expertise and then like exit them and then just like purchase products through them all the time and then ask them questions every year? You know, we have a great relationship with Los Angeles, and I'm sure we always will. So how you kind of prove it is you have, they gave us a bunch of non-prospects and said like, hey, can you improve these guys' velocity in extended spring training? And in this group, a couple of them broke out significantly. And in fact, one of them went from, his name's Andrew Isler. He's like 5'8", 5'7", righty from Duke, two-way player, kind of like Marcus Stroman. Drafted in the late rounds, had a good slider, threw strikes. He was 86 to 88 and had a literal 10 ERA in short season the year prior. So he's slated to be cut for sure, signed for $1,000 probably. So then he goes to throwing 92 to 95 and up to 97 and was a double-A all-star and got traded this year. And then another one was Corey Copping, who was an Oklahoma pitcher and had okay success his first year. And then his velocity ticked up massively. And then ended up in AAA this year and got traded as well. So basically, you're creating these tradable, fungible assets out of non-prospects that were traded for real players. And so then when other players see that, that's how that clicks. And that kind of starts to address your question, where it's like, I played with Andrew Isler last year, and he sucked. You know, and now he pitched 7 times in big league camp in the next year, and like they love him. I'm like, what happened? How does he throw 95 now? Why? And so then when you put that spark in someone's mind, it starts to eliminate that effect, you know. But that being said, yeah, you certainly have non-compliant people, for sure. And that's what our customer service department is built for sure. Our training fees are the lowest in the industry. And as a result, we're oversubscribed. You know, we're sold out. So we get to pick the people that we want, that we think that are going to train the way that we want, because if we're going to charge very low amounts of money comparatively, and our gym loses money, it runs in the red. If that's going to happen, then we need to, why do we do it? One, for marketing purposes, you know, if we have the best, most engaged clients, we get the best results. And then two, for research, because part of their fee is subjecting themselves to data collection. And then if we have highly compliant people like that, then it's good for both sides of the business. So hopefully that kind of answers the question. But
definitely.
Yeah, generally, well, we have had cases where people are non-compliant. And as a result, you just have to kind of dissuade them from doing the stuff. And you know, in fairness, we're not perfect. You know, we don't always get great results with every client. That's true. That's all. That always will be true. And it's something we're chasing down and trying to get more efficient at. And it's actually something that we really, really focus on right now. That's just, we're human as well.
I mean, that's a very good answer, and also sort of helps fit together. You know, we've talked to a fair number now of minor leaguers throughout the Mariners organization, obviously not too many from other organizations, but and really a lot of this information seems to spread not really from a coaching down perspective, which I think is just from an outsider perspective how you might assume a transfer of information would happen in you know, in a baseball organization of, you know, the coach, you know, the front office is instructing the coaches to teach this way. This is how we hit. This is how we pitch. You know, but that so much of this training and so much of these sort of improvements and adjustments seem to now be happening, or at least the drive to go seek out these sorts of training are happening, starting with player to player conversations. I mean, that's what it sounds like, especially in this regard, right? That they're essentially your ambassadors, you know, these guys who are coming.
Yeah, and that was actually Andrew Friedman's advice to me many years ago. As this is a good story because it involves Seattle. The Rays are coming out to visit. They're playing.
When Friedman was with the Rays, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and yeah. I've known Matt Arnold, who's now the AGM of the Brewers, but he was the director of pro scouting then, so I knew him. We had a relationship. And he's like, I want you to meet Eric Neander, Chaim Bloom, Andrew Friedman, and we're going to sit down and we're going to talk about maybe bringing you on to Tampa. And I said, oh, great. So he's like, yeah, let's meet at the hotel after the game. Here's the address and blah, blah, blah. So as I'm taking the bus down, I realized that, like, Felix is throwing a perfect game against them. And I'm like, no, not fucking today. Like, of all the days. And then sure enough, obviously, he throws a perfect game against them. And I'm like, God, come on, really? Like, the day I have an interview, like... And so, unfortunately, none of them really cared. But, like, it was just really funny. And Friedman, you know, it was great. He wanted to talk more about business. And Andrew said, you know, why don't you become the next, you know, guru that makes a ton of money? Why do you want to work in Pro Bowl? And I said, at the time, I said, I don't think that's possible. I said, I think if I demonstrate that I can train players, you know, sufficiently, that, like, if I do that, then a team is going to pick me up, you know. And that's not what happened, obviously. But Andrew said, you know, he's like, maybe that's true. He's like, but I can tell you this. Like, if you train players and the players pressure the coaches and pressure the front office to make a change, like, that will ultimately be infinitely more successful than a top-down approach. He's like, you're looking at it like the GM is a dictator and can do whatever he wants and, like, tell people what to do. And he's like, I'm telling you that that's not quite true. He's like, but if you have from the bottom up, you know, where, like, the players are demanding change, like, that causes the coaches discomfort. It causes chance for disruption. And I didn't quite understand that because I think, like, a lot of other fans, people want to, like, a great example right now is, like in Philadelphia. Everyone wants Kapler fired and Klentak. And whether they should be fired, who knows? Like, the Phillies were, how quickly we forget that the Phillies were the worst team ever last year.
Yeah.
And, are, you know, like, probably had no business being this good. And whether it's Klentak's, you know, it's to his credit or Gabe's, who knows. But I think people think, like, Klentak is, like, this GM or Jerry or anyone that can, like, make these changes on the drop of a hat. And maybe they can, right? But first of all, they're generally good people. So, like, they don't want to do that because that's not nice.
Yeah.
And then secondly, that's not – there's political capital inside of baseball. So if you're the GM and you're constantly making decisions that are undermining your employees – there's a time and a place for that. That has to happen. That's called being the boss, you know. But, like, you can't always do that and then expect people to be effective at their jobs. And so many GMs are held hostage by the bureaucracy of labor, the bureaucracy of the coaches. Because what are you going to do? Are you going to fire every single pitching coach and coordinator? Like, well, like Jeff Luhnow did that with Houston, and it worked out really well. But people, so, like, well, what does that require? That requires the support of the owner, right, to let you do whatever the hell you want, right, which is not the common inside baseball.
Right.
And then two, like, Jeff is worked at McKinsey. He's a management consultant. He's had experience inside professional baseball before he became a GM. So he understands, like, how to hire, how to fire, how to run an organization. He understands how to run a business, right, which is how the Astros are run and how most teams are not. Right, so when I worked there for 2.5 years, the number one thing I took from Jeff was the strength of conviction. Like, whether Jeff is right or wrong, he does a ton of research. He has brilliant people around him, no doubt. But his strength to act and be convicted in his decisions are impressive. And, like, that's – I think there's a lot bad you can say about Jeff, and I think most of them are fair. But I don't have a problem with him. And primarily, like, that's the thing I took from him. And that's kind of what we embody at Driveline and hope we can work with a major league team that is interested in doing the same thing.
I'm a big fan of the show The Good Place, which is a Mike Schur show. And I was listening to the podcast the other day, and he says the way that he can, because, you know, he's behind Parks and Rec and The Office, and did some work on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, just a track record of success on things that he's touched. And his clarion call kind of is best idea wins. And it doesn't matter if it comes from him, and it doesn't matter if it comes from somebody who's like a writer's assistant. The best idea always trumps any other idea. And you have to, he preaches a lot about taking ego out of it. Baseball is a sport that is, well, I mean, maybe that's not unique to baseball, but definitely there's ego at play. There's ego in running a business. There's ego in running a business in baseball, I'm sure. How are you able to move past, this is a reflection of me, and take the ego out of it in order to get to the place of best idea wins?
Yeah, I think we've done a good job of that at Driveline, because we hire primarily affectionately. There's a bunch of people in this room, so I want to be nice about it. But we hire affectionately just miscreants, you know, because I am one myself. I'm a college dropout. I'm a loser in a lot of ways, you know. And those people are inspired, are encouraged to come up with their own ideas and encouraged to challenge the status quo, because that's who we are, you know, and that's how the business is going to survive and it's going to grow. So I don't, now there's a lot of people out there who say, you know, I love being proven wrong. I love being, you know, told that, you know, I'm not right and the best idea wins. Like, I think that's bullshit. I don't think anyone actually likes that. There's no way. There's no way people actually, there's that deep feeling inside of you. I've always, it's you always have two reactions to an event, right? Your first reaction you can't control, right? It's purely emotional, right? Like it's rage inducing. It's funny. It's whatever. And it's the second one that when you take action over it, and that's the one that defines who you are as a human. So, like, I don't like being proven wrong. I don't like being told that what I've kind of set out to do is right. I would prefer that everything I have thought to be true, because that makes me look like a genius. But that's certainly not the case. And if you can understand that the growth of the business depends on your ability to be malleable, then I think it's really important that that's something you embrace. And I'm not always perfect at it, but I think I do a good job of that. And I don't see a lot of that in baseball, for sure, especially at the middle management layers. The real problem is that many of the front offices that I've worked with are good at that. You have people that are forward thinking, that understand that the best idea wins. But then when you get down to the coach level, you don't have that understanding. And so then there's this huge disconnect between what you would like to have done and then who is going to execute it. And then if you constantly just say, what's the intermediate step? We're going to take an intermediate step in 2019 and we're going to roll out this pitching idea, this hitting idea. And then you do this over and over and over again. It's like, dude, you have a 3-year GM contract. Like, you cannot be doing this. Like, if your farm system sucks, or if it's like in mediocre, or the big league team is like, you have to take action. You have to be willing to be right. Like, people say, like, oh, you have to be willing to be wrong. I look at it from the positive way. You aren't giving your chance. You aren't giving your chance. You aren't giving yourself a chance to succeed. Like, you have to be willing to win. And by being willing to win, yes, you have to be willing to lose. But, like, most people just select for lower risk. They're not trying to actually win anything. And I see that in baseball all the time. Like, it's just really frustrating. So that's the big thing that's, I think, sets us apart. We're willing to actually win and take risks.
Is that a lesson learned from being a professional poker player for a stint?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's 100%. So many people think, I've tweeted this the other day, that the risk-reward spectrum, every time that's invoked, over 90%, literally 100% of the time I've heard it invoked, is, oh, it's risk-reward, which means we have to reduce the amount of reward because it's so much lower risk. You know, we can't do this because it's too risky. It's like, you know what's risky? Like time. Like, Father Time is undefeated in this game. At 26, you're old in this game. At 26, you're 28, you're old. You don't have a choice. Like, Emilio recognized that he's old in this game. Is Emilio actually old? No. Right? But for him, repeating AA 3 times, it doesn't look good. You know? Mm-hmm. He's a college third baseman turned pitcher. He understands where he's at, you know, in this game. And that's very rare in this society, because the coaches tell the players, you're just one adjustment away. You know, just keep doing what you're doing. You're totally fine. You know, you'll start getting guys out. You need to command the ball better, and they're not given a plan to succeed. So when they get released, it's a shock to them, you know, and so they're never given a chance to win. And that's something that a professional gambler understands, and an investor, hedge fund manager, someone that works in gambling in any form of what you want to call it, understands it innately, because they have to.
Do you still have an interest in working in like a baseball front office in sort of that comprehensive way? Having had time in front offices and obviously having worked with multiple front offices now versus having sort of, I guess, not necessarily creative control, but having the means to sort of direct everything in your own private work. I mean, is that still sort of the goal for you, or has the goal changed?
Yeah, I used to think that I wanted to be the director of player development of a team, mm-hmm. and then I found out that that person doesn't actually direct any player development. It's like a very weirdly named term. They're the farm director often, and then they mm-hmm. basically just decide who's promoted and not promoted and mm-hmm. released and all that. And so I'm like, oh, that doesn't sound like fun. Mm-hmm. It also doesn't sound like something I'd be good at. So as I've kind of moved on, I turned down a team in 2014 to become a pitching coordinator, and I bet on myself to basically do full driveline full time, which mm-hmm. worked out. But I have since turned down every offer to kind of be directly employed. I've turned down jobs to interview as the assistant general manager at places. I just don't see it being I don't see how I would actually help the organization compared to where I'm at. Like, why not just bring me into contract and work mm-hmm. that way? If you read Levi Weaver's article, allegedly I've been doing work for some team that he's named. can't really talk about it much. But at the end of the day, sure. like, I think that's how I would like to work with the teams, is work externally, and then I would like to sign an exclusive deal. I would like to sign an exclusive deal that we work together. A team asked me once, would you be willing to sign an exclusive deal with us and you can't work with any other professional team? I said, sure, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, and that cost is, you know, this X mm-hmm. million dollars. And they're like, okay. They're like, well, would you still work with other professional pitchers like Trevor? And I said, yeah, of course. Like, well, what would it cost to buy you out so you never work with professional pitchers? And I'm like, I don't know, 80 million? And they're just like, what? You know, this was like 2 years ago. They're like, why so much? Like, we're not going to pay that. And I'm like, because, like, Trevor's going to win a Cy Young some year. And, like, these guys are going to be good. And, like, the future earnings, you're buying out my future earnings forever for that, you know. And, if I think about it, actually, I think AD's pretty small now that I think about it. But baseball doesn't quite operate that way yet. You know, they don't. Yeah. All of business operates in the way that I would like to do business, and baseball doesn't yet, which is, like, for example, like hedge funds and trading companies, there are contractors who come in and act as like C-level as a service. So they come in and they act as your CTO, your CIO, and they come in and they do like executive level decisions so your talented people can just trade. And mm-hmm. so then they can make a ton of money, which is all that really matters to you, right? And you mm-hmm. pay them millions of dollars a year to handle all of that. And on baseball, it's like, that's kind of unheard of. You know, the teams call us and then they just like, hey, we're going to poach your employees. Like, okay, like, that's fine. You know, my employees don't really want to work in professional baseball because they understand how bad it is. So there's that. But, like, secondarily, like, that's not going to solve your problem. Like, you're not going to solve the pain you have, Mr. Assistant General Manager, by stealing my girlfriend. Like, that's not going to solve mm-hmm. the problem. Like, your problem is that you don't have a system set up. So by putting a driveline, quote-unquote, person in there in a system that you still have, it causes both of them to hate their lives, which has happened twice already. And that's immaturity / not understanding of an employee leaving here to understand they're going to a bad situation. And then the team not understanding that they're putting the person in a bad situation, because it truly is a systems problem. It's not a one person can solve it. So I don't have a lot of interest in going into professional baseball. I told the GM when he asked me like what I would want to do, I said, probably, like, ultimately, I think if, like, we're as successful as I think we're going to be and we develop a lot of players with an organization, then the only job I really want is the big league pitching coach job, to which he laughed his ass off. And then he's like, I actually could see that, because, like, if we have a bunch of pitchers who are interested in this kind of thing that respond to that, that would make sense. Mm-hmm. And I said, great, well, in 5 years we can talk about it then. So that's the job. But in the front office, nah, I already have the best GM job in baseball. So I'm good.
Yeah, you would lose the opportunity to, if you were just limited to one system, you know, you would lose the opportunity to work with, as you said, kind of the self-selected players who, came to you, you know, you'd have to deal with players who felt like you were being forced on them, or the Driveline philosophy was being forced on them. Who I feel like the current crop of players is so much more data aware, and you know, they don't look at data as something that's scary about them as much as some of the older players do. A lot of them see data as like a cudgel that's wielded against them. And the younger group of players definitely seems to understand more that they're tools. But, you know, you would lose that ability to control your clientele to an extent, which would probably not be great on the bottom line. I mean, you wouldn't have the same success that you're having now, would you?
Right, that, and then there's just the future unbounded upside of Driveline Baseball. You know, we think our competitors are like the Houston Astros and the Los Angeles Dodgers. You know, like, they're our vendors, so, you know, we're supplying them. But, like, who do we really compete against? Do we compete against these pitching gurus that are out there? No, I don't think so. You know, we're going to compete with, can we innovate faster than the MLB teams? And if we can, we continue to earn their business. That's just good business. Mm-hmm. You know, if we continue to innovate faster than the major league teams, then we have stuff to sell them. If we don't, then they don't want to buy from us, you know. But we think that we can outwork most of Major League Baseball, because we have smart people here, for sure. But we just have the freedom, right? We have people that are willingly interested in subjecting themselves to research. We have 450 people that are coming in every year, professional athletes, college athletes, and much more than that, you know, probably 1,000 or so. And so then they're all willing to go through biomechanical testing. We're taking it to Notre Dame. We're taking it to Vanderbilt. We're taking it to North Carolina. We're taking our mobile lab. You know, we can deploy our mobile lab anywhere in the country. So by getting all of this data nationwide, we crush what the major league teams can do on a massive scale. And that's at the company's scale right now, which is 27 employees. You know, we anticipate growing significantly more than that. And as a result, we have this huge network of data and process that, you know, realistically, I think eventually a major league team will totally understand. Like, we just need to pay them X million dollars to revamp what we're doing for the price of, what did you say, a couple Lawson Romines, I believe, right? So,
yeah.
Like, that's
exactly.
Andrew, not even Austin.
Yeah.
Not even Austin.
Would that it was Austin Romine.
My bad. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah. I get confused, right? So, it's an interesting situation. And, obviously, the elephant in the room is the Mariners stuff. And so, while you obviously know that I can't talk too much about it,
sure,
I'm still really good friends with a lot of people in the front office, and I know they're listening. So, but I'm still really good friends with them, and I think that it's a great organization. I just understand, I now understand more than ever how hard it is to make a decision like this, because it requires doing something in uncertain times, right? It requires really going all in. Like, there's no way you can be halfway. Like, if you're going to do something like this, it's going to be identified like, there's a ton of value here, and we need to make a complete change about what we're doing. And the Astros did that in a very short amount of time, and it yielded huge results. And then the Indians did it over a little bit longer of a time period, and it yielded great results too. Different results, but great results. And so I think it requires the ability to get everyone on the same page, which is very hard in professional baseball.
Is that the biggest, I was going to ask, what do you think the biggest inefficiency in the way that teams train, or major league teams train or operate, unless that you've just answered that question?
One is, there's a current rash of to hire, this has happened in multiple organizations and in different sports too. So, like, this is a truly grass is greener on the other side, right? So I'm a baseball team. Oh, this person did really awesome work in NASCAR, for example. This is an actual example. Like, let's bring this person in who understands sleep patterns and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, NASCAR is not baseball. Like, it just isn't, right? It has a different speed of, like, sports science, how you actually collect the data, how the people interact, right, the type of personnel you have. This happens in soccer, too. So, like, EPL in soccer is spending tons of money on sports scientists from rugby, for example, because Australia turns out a lot of sports scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Some in America, too, in basketball. Basketball turns out a ton of sports science. There's a lot of people on the NBA side. And so then they poach these people. Oh, this guy was the sports scientist for the Lakers. This guy was the head strength conditioning coach for the Lakers. This guy was so on and so forth for the Jazz, blah, blah, blah. And they bring him in. They're like, you don't understand shit about soccer. Like, why are we paying you $500,000 a year, you know, to make these changes? And this is, like, the biggest current inefficient thing that's happening right now, is trying to bring people from other jurisdictions over here, because baseball has a lot of the speed and the culture and the language of how it is done is so different than any other sport. You know, you have obviously a huge Latin American component to it, which people, I think, don't quite grasp how important that is.
Mm-hmm.
You have the fact that, like, the vast majority, I don't know if it's the vast majority, but a large percentage of the players are not college educated and come from the South, which have a huge, like, impact on how you talk to them and how they it can process information. Right. Well, all the ridiculous tweets that are surfacing is evidence of that.
Yep.
And so it has a different speed on how you speak to them, how you gain their trust. Right. Because the first thing they want to know is, did you play Major League Baseball? No. Okay. Like, why should I trust you? And so then the only things that players respond to generally are, one, did you play Major League Baseball? No. Okay. Well, then two, do you know infinitely more than me about something and then you can help me? And if you can't answer yes to either or both, then, like, you have no value to them and they're not going to listen. And so then, like, the most inefficient thing that's happening right now is hiring expertise that is ignorant of baseball, the baseball kind of lexicon right now.
So something you mentioned there that I wanted to ask about, but you touched on, and I'm even more curious about, is in the many different ways that you're looking to expand Driveline and just generally how sort of these training, the way that you're expanding and learning more about proper training methods, how do you have, I guess, experience or interest or plans on how you can expand the sort of training that you're doing beyond just working with people in the U.S. I mean, working in Latin America. Have you had experiences with you know, working with guys in Latin America or in Japan or in, you know, I mean, Australia? Just generally, you know, I mean, obviously that you know, that shift is such an important and significant component of what makes up Major League Baseball. And I would imagine that the training itself translates pretty well. But, you know, I mean, have you had experience making those sort of leaps, and what have been sort of the, I guess, challenges in doing that, if you have had those experiences?
Yeah, recently we've had players come from all over. We've had Dominican players here. When we've worked with, like, the Dodgers and a few other teams, there have been Latin American players there. But I think the larger question is, you know, like, how can we engage, go to the Dominican Republic? How can we go to those places and actually work with them? And so this is something that I think about a lot. One, we have Spanish speaking people on staff here. But to me, kind of it ties in exactly with my last answer, which is that is insufficient, right? Because the fact that you just speak Spanish. So, for example, if we go to the Dominican Republic, there is a huge difference in, like, where the players are sourced from, right? They're sourced from Pascones, like, they have, like, control of them, and it's kind of a corrupt system down there. So navigating that is kind of interesting. But then even if you work in an academy, right, you work with, say, the Mariners Academy or whatever, I am very sensitive to culture kind of appropriation. Like, I think it's really not understood how important that is to people to feel good. So, like, going and speaking Spanish to a Latin American player, like, that's great because they see, like, oh, wow, this guy actually speaks some Spanish. I can communicate with him on some level. But if we go to the Dominican Republic and it's a bunch of white and Asian men going down there and just being like, hey, we have people that speak Spanish. Isn't that fucking great? It's like, that's not, like, that ain't it.
Sure.
You know, like, actually understanding who they are, where they come from, the challenges they face is extremely important. So we have a professional pitcher who's Mexican. He was born in L.A., but his entire family is Mexican. He is Mexican. He's pitched in Mexico in AAA down there in the Mexican League as a native Mexican. He has a Mexican passport. So by all accounts, he's a Mexican.
Sure.
And having him around, like, on these trips, immediately changes when I watch him deal with Dominican players and players from Latin America, because yes, he speaks Spanish, right? But his understanding of culture and understanding of Latin American understanding is infinitely higher than any of us, right? So that's the thing that I think is missing from where we're at right now and making that expansion. And it's something that we're actively attacking right now. So I think that is really underappreciated inside baseball. Like, why why are the lower levels of baseball flooded? Highest percentage of Latin Americans are at the lowest level of baseball. Mm-hmm. Huge. And mm-hmm. then at AA, AAA, there's not, right? There's the, you have the stock stereotypical answer, mm-hmm. you know, which is almost racist, which is like, oh, they're just not good players. And like, mm-hmm. they don't understand and they don't develop, you know, and then American college players and high school players just develop better. Mm-hmm. It's like, or could it be the fact that like no one speaks fucking Spanish in this organization, you know, and like, the yep. food, it's like, oh yeah, well like we pay for food. It's like, do you understand that they've never seen sliced lunch meat ever? Like that's not a thing. Mm-hmm. And in Dominican, like they won't eat that because like, oh, isn't it weird? They don't eat sliced turkey. It's like, no, not really. Like that's not a thing. Like when they think about chicken or turkey, they think about, I don't know, like rotisserie chicken, right? Like something mm-hmm. that looks like a chicken, mm-hmm. right? So dietary stuff is like often not paid attention to. Just like it's small, it's things that people think yeah. are small, but then if you move to a different country, you would like totally like think the same way. You'd be like, I can't believe there's no accommodation for me.
And it's here, putting people yeah. in a position to succeed with all the other things you can control, right?
Right. It's already bad enough they're 8,000 miles away or however far, and they don't see a single person out there that looks like them, right? The other part mm-hmm. of it is like just the basic things in life that you take granted for, right? Like where you sleep, where you eat, what you drink, what's available, what the entertainment options are. Mm-hmm. When those are all different, right, you're adding a huge amount of stress to the person's life, mm-hmm. and then you're expecting them to compete on the highest level of professional baseball, usually at an age inappropriate level. Usually mm-hmm. the Dominicans that play are young for their level, right? Mm-hmm. So those are the things that I think are really holding baseball back in a lot of ways. Generally, I think it's getting a lot better really fast. But it's what I think about when I'm trying to integrate with Latin American initiatives. You know, people are like, why don't you just go down there? There's tons of players who sign for like $5,000 that'll never make it over here. You just roll out a weighted ball program. You have 200 of them. Like eventually some guys will throw 100. It's like, that's not really kind of the point of what we're trying to do here. You know, like I understand mm-hmm. based on like the three things you watched on YouTube about Driveline that you think that's what you do. You know, but like actually this is a business and we care about like sustainably running it and like giving a shit and not exposing our employees to like disastrous outcomes. Mm-hmm. So like those are the things that we think about. So whoever's out there that thinks that we're just a weighted ball company, maybe they should listen to the last 10 minutes. See, like the depth of what I think about on a line of business that we haven't even come close to developing yet. But the international market is really exciting. And to close it is I'm really excited to figure out how we can start integrating with it and develop it, because we have a ton of interest from Japan, ton of interest from the Dominican, ton of interest from Mexico. And we want to just make, and these people are like, just come on down, just help us out. Mm-hmm. And my response is always to kind of push it off, not because we're not ready, but because we don't even know what that would look like. It's very naive to imagine that the American business model we have here would work over there instantly, mm-hmm. right? What is that? Who's going to own it? Who's going to live there? And it's a lot of discussions that I think have to be had.
What do you wish that trainees knew before they walked into Driveline?
Every time I ask myself that question, when we get it enough, I just make sure that it goes out in an email to the welcome email, because we do a good job of saying like, this is exactly what's going to happen. If you don't meet these strength standards, these things, you won't be able to do this, this, this. And so we bombard these kids with tons of stuff. But the one thing that you can't impart is, like, for the amount of shit talking that the pro pitchers do is so much higher than any amateur player. So they just see that, right? They see them having fun. They see them like clowning around and all that. And baseball is meant to be fun, and it should be that way. But what they don't see is that when it's time to lift, it's time to throw, every time they make a technical execution of a rep, there's no talking. Right, in the best trainees we have, like there's ultimate focus, and that's hard, right? And so they have the correlation arrow backwards, right? What they should say, it's impossible to be focused 100% of the time if that's all you do. So the clowning around and the shit talking is a way to bridge the dead time between the focus, right? And so that's how they do a good job of breaking up their focus, whereas amateur players, they don't respect that Father Time is undefeated. You know, they probably have not had injuries, right? A lot of things that they're just naive about. And those are lessons, unfortunately, that I think are only learned one way, which is the hard way. So that's something I wish they knew, but I think those things are not knowable until bad things happen to you, and you learn how to react to that.
You hear a lot of younger players talking about how And I've always thought that this is a funny thing to say. Like, when I asked Ben Gamble what is the biggest thing he learned from Robinson Cano, he says, it's just the way he goes about his business. Just, and you get that answer from so many guys. Oh, the way he goes about his business. I was like, is the business really that hard? Like, how is it so hard that none of these guys can grasp it? But I think maybe a better way to say it, and the way that you say it here, I think more elegantly, is maybe going about his business is understanding that break between the focus points, that you have the focus and you have the joking around, and when it's time to focus, you focus. So
yeah. Maybe. Yeah, and it's just a maturity thing, too. A Seattle legend, a good friend of mine, Raul Ibanez. Mm. And so mm-hmm. Raul was playing for the Yankees and finishing up his career. And a player came up to him and said, you know, oh, man, I can't believe we're making the All-Star break. It's about time. My body's just devastated. You know, like, you know, yours has got to feel terrible. You're 40 or whatever. And Raul just looks at him. He's like, no, it's fine. I'm fine. The guy's like, how? I'm 25 and I feel like I'm just like I'm getting crushed. And Raul's like, I don't know. I go to bed at midnight and not like fucking 4 a.m. every night or whatever. You know, like I actually treat this like a job because it is one. You know, and Raul's like, it's not that difficult, right? Everyone knows what they have to do in professional baseball. It doesn't mean they do it, right? But it's just like simple stuff like that, and that's why having a guy like that around helps a ton. You know, like Dee Gordon, for example. I'm not sure, you know, exactly what he was saying in that interview, but that's probably what they try to get it across that way. You know, like your time is limited in this game, and what Raul would always tell kids, and he does today. He works for the Dodgers and helps out. And he tries to impart, like, you know, Raul's story is good because he was a low draft pick and had to, you know, grind his way all the way up through Kansas City to even make it to where he was. And so he spent a ton of time in the minor leagues. And so a big part of it is just, like, this is a job. Like, it sucks. It's a seasonal apprenticeship or whatever minor league baseball wants to call it. Right? But, like, to maximize the opportunity, it's going to require, you know, a huge amount of sacrifice. And the phrase that I've taken to enjoying is that I'm sure a ton of people have said it, but I always attribute it to John Carmack, the creator of Quake and Doom. Carmack used to say, like, focus is merely a decision of what you're not going to do, not like what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. Like, just what am I going to sacrifice? What are the things that I'm not going to do so I can achieve this? Because if you're focused on what you can do or whatever, then you just don't have the attitude of someone that wants to work and no one can help, right? But there's tons of people who I think really do want to put in the work, but get really led astray by how they go about their business, for example, right? And what's important to them. So I think that's probably the direction those people are trying to take it.
Maybe that's why so many of the greats are just really, really pretty boring people. You know, like Mike Trout is about as interesting as a piece of bread because he's always had that focus, right? Had that decision-making ability, which I think is somewhat innate. You can't necessarily teach good decision making.
Yeah, there's a mental game kind of quote that excellence is mundane, right? It's not the people that do things amazingly. It's the people that do the small things extremely well. And Trout's approach is similar to that. Like Trevor and I like to talk about it. If you look, and I know these numbers don't mean anything necessarily, but if you look up like Trevor Bauer versus Mike Trout, like his pitcher on batter, like it's a very hilarious set of stats where he, like, Trevor walks him a lot, he punches him out a lot, and like Trout, like when he gets hits bombs, like hits doubles off of Trevor.
It's three,
like,
true outcomes.
Yeah, Trevor's like, I know what he's trying to do. Like, I know exactly what he's trying to do. Like, he does not swing at fastballs up. He loves pitches down. You know, like, I know exactly what he's trying to do. He does not ever deviate from it. He has a polarized approach. He keeps things extremely simple, and he's very hard to fool. Like, he has a very dumb approach at the plate. But he executes it better than anyone in baseball, right? Everyone in the league knows that you shouldn't throw fastballs down to Trout. But guess what every pitcher trains their whole life to do?
Yep.
Is to pound the bottom of the zone. So, like, even if you tell a guy to throw fastballs up, he's going to miss sometimes. And if you miss up, then it's a ball. And if you miss down when you're up in the zone, it's a dick shot, right? So, like,
yep.
Trout's going to hit it for a home run. So, like, he's not stupid. Like, he understands, like, this is the thing. There was a great article that Jeff Sullivan wrote. I don't know if this is still true, but, like, the way to cheat against Mike Trout is to throw him an 0-0 curveball because he took 100% of the 0-0 curveballs he saw. And of the curveballs that were landed for strikes, like, it's just a free strike if you land an 0-0 curveball. The problem is that when Trout gets to 0-1 after an 0-0 curveball, he becomes a better hitter than when he's 0-0. which was like the greatest stat I've ever heard about it. Like literally anyone, but Mike Trout too. Like Sullivan wrote this a couple of years ago, and I'm like, that is so awesome. That his only weakness just makes him angry and makes him a better player. And so like Trevor's like, it's awesome. He's like, he has a polarized approach. He realizes like this is what he's gonna do. And I'm just not going to throw him any. Like he once threw him a curveball that nearly bounced and Trout hit it off the wall. And Mickey Callaway was like, oh, that was a great pitch. You know, you just, you know, executed great. He just hit it. And Trevor's like, it's not a good pitch. Like, just Trout does that every – have you watched SportsCenter? Like, Trout, he does that all the time. Like, you know, it's like that's just what he does. He goes to where pitchers are going to go. You know, and he has a very boring approach, in my opinion, but he executes it extremely well.
Yep.
I think that's a big part of it.
Yep.
Is there a player, and maybe you couldn't say current just for business purposes, but is there a specific player that you've always thought of, like you wish you could have had the opportunity to work with, or if they were still in their prime, or if there is a current one now that you feel comfortable saying with that you...
I used to wanted to work with Lincecum, of course, and then sure. I got the opportunity to work with Tim, mm-hmm. and it was a lot of fun. You know, it was fun mm-hmm. to work with Tim. He worked his ass off, and that's another one. Oh, like Drive yeah. couldn't save Tim's career,
yes.
And certainly I wish I could have, but
sure.
No lack of effort from Tim's point of view. I promise you that. Obviously, some things happened in his life that were really detrimental, and I think that was a big part, you know, of why. That was really disruptive to his training and to his career. Mm-hmm. But it was fun to work with Tim because it was interesting, you know, convincing him and working with him. Like, you're not going to be the pitcher at University of Washington. You know, that's not going to happen, mm-hmm. you know. But, like, you can be the guy that won Comeback Player of the Year with the Giants. Like, and that turned into a reliever that was unstoppable in the World Series. It's possible. Mm-hmm. It obviously didn't work out on both sides, but, you know, it ended amicably. And I think Tim and I worked, you know, well together. You know, honestly, Trevor was someone that I wanted to work with at a young – when I was just coming up, and it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's been fun to work with Trevor. I think that, you know, when he came up, he's been, you know, certainly – I think he's learned a lot about how to handle the media. I'll put it that way. he's also matured a lot. But I think an interesting thing about Trevor is that he's just like a pretty average guy. Like, I think people ascribe these weird things to him. Like, he likes to fly drones and all this other stuff, and he's really weird. And in reality, like, we watch football, you know, like, we just kind of hang out, we make stupid jokes, and he's a good friend of a lot of people here at Driveline. And so those are pretty much the people that, there's obviously the fun answers that I could name, like Jason Nabergall is a good one, the man that broke Pecota, Georgia Tech pitcher who threw 102 miles an hour before everyone was throwing 102.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like how they could have handled him. There's just a lot of people that I think were especially in the 90s and 2000s, mm-hmm. I think were handled completely incorrectly. Like, they were never given the chance to be 100%. Like, that kind of era is defined by the concept of we need to do pitch counts and we need to focus on mechanics and we need to, like, keep these guys healthy. And it was not defined by let's make them as good as possible, which is kind of what I think is changed. I think that's happening now. And so... You didn't ask, but my favorite pitcher to watch in the game now is born from this idea that, like, let's get the absolute most out of this player, and let's put him in the big leagues, and let's get the most. And to me, that is Edwin Diaz. Mm. Like, I was at his debut.
Oh, man.
So I was, because Trevor pitched. Yeah. Trevor started against Paxton. Every time Trevor pitches against Seattle, ridiculous stuff happens. Trevor pitched, like, first time he pitched here that I saw him, he pitched against Chris Young, who was literally sitting, like, 80.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they turned off the gun because Chris was throwing 80. And Trevor's like, what the? You can't turn off the radar gun. Like, I use it to calibrate my pitches. And then Andy Chavez hit a home run off of him, which is, like, the first time in, like, 1,400 plate appearances or whatever. And he was like, okay, great. And then he faced Taijuan Walker, who the week prior was throwing like 89-93.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, I'm gonna crush Taijuan. I've played against him in Double A a ton. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in the Diamondbacks organization, you know, when they were coming up together, those rotations were you know, great to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And then Taijuan sat 97 and punched out like 14 guys or whatever.
Yeah.
And Trevor was like, this is bullshit, man. Like. Like, this is ridiculous. And then he faced Paxton this year, and he was just, or last year.
Yeah.
And he was like, all right, like, I've faced this guy in Jackson a million times. He sucks. Like, that's fine. Because Trevor doesn't really watch a lot of baseball, so he didn't understand how good James was. And so then he hears him warming up, and he's like, who is warming up? Like, someone is throwing, like, a million miles an hour. Oh, and he sits down, and then Kipnis is leaning off, and he's just like, the first pitch is like 99, and Trevor's like, ah, it's clearly wrong. And then he's just like, all right, great. Yeah, he just sits 99 now. That's good. You know. And so then Andrew called me, and he's like, hey, we moved up Diaz and Altavilla, you know, pretty close together.
Yeah.
And he's like, Diaz is a starter for us, and then they converted him to reliever. And then he's like, he sits like 95. He's awesome. And I'm like, oh, great. You know, I can't wait to see him. And then sure enough, the Mariners are losing, and then they bring out Diaz. And I'm like, oh, this is the guy that Andrew wants me to see. And he's warming up, and I'm like, that's not 95. And just sat 100.
No, it's not.
And then Trevor's like, are you fucking kidding? Like, they just have this guy in Double A who, like, throws 100 miles an hour. Like, no one's ever heard of this guy. And Trevor's like, and to Trevor says, he's like, to this day, it's like the most electric debut he's ever seen. He's like, I'm just sitting on the bench. I see this, you know, I see Edwin Diaz, who's like 5'11 or whatever.
Yep. With
huge long arms, just punching our hitters out. Every hitter's coming back to the bench like they have. Because, like, Kipnis came back and he's like, all right, thank God Paxton is out. And they bring in Diaz and he's like, fuck. Like, that's what I thought. The Mariners did an awesome job. They realized, like, Altavilla and Diaz are both not going to be starters because their changeup is not developing or whatever, so let's get the most out of them.
Yeah.
And then both made huge jumps to the pen. And so I thought that was really cool. So that's the stuff that's really exciting.
We're big fans of that. I think we are collectively all a little concerned that you can't necessarily, I mean, you could turn everyone into a reliever, but, like,
yeah, maybe.
But, like, someone, until you commit to that, someone does have to start a baseball game. So that part of it, I think we're a little concerned about. But yeah.
I think for those two people though, they're kind of very much shorter. You know, Dan was a small college pitcher,
sure.
And so I think that there were some. I agree that you don't want to convert people to relief. You know, a former boss of mine, he started piggybacking people in the minor leagues, and there was a lot of bitching from the coaches. They're like, this sucks, it's extra work, and the relievers don't get any work, you know. And then the general manager, who's a friend of mine, said, if you make a right-hander a reliever, like, you better be right, because he's completely worthless to our organization. Like, he's like, if you make a right-handed starter a right-handed reliever, the chances that this guy is ever useful to us is, like, basically zero. Which is true, if you think about it. Like, think about how many right-handed relievers exist at the minor league levels that have no impact on the major league level, right? So, like, when you convert someone like Diaz or Altavilla, I think in both cases, the Mariners, like, had strong inclination that these guys would be big leaguers fast, you know? And they were, and they're both going to be very impactful for the organization, you know? But if you make, like, if you were to make Andrew Moore a reliever, which was, like, kind of, when he got drafted, I remember people were talking, like, well, he can relieve, and I'm like, there is zero value if Andrew becomes a reliever. Yeah. Like, he's in command. He's going to be a guy that throws strikes, four pitches for strikes. At his best, he's going to be an extreme fly ball pitcher. And he can be an effective pitcher in the big leagues. I believe that. But, like, if you make him a reliever, like, you've destroyed the value. He can pitch 200 innings a year. He's durable. Like, that's going to be who he is. So I agree for sure. If you make those guys relievers, it's like you're ruining the chance to develop Andrew as a number three.
Yeah, I mean, as, you know, Mariners fans and certainly as, like, Felix fans, as well as just, you know, watching guys like Andrew and guys like Chase Young and you know, the many, you know, pitchers who certainly have the ability to throw 180, 200 innings and, you know, have that sort of positive impact, but are not necessarily going to get that leap in velocity or leap in movement from the bullpen. You know, it is an interesting thing, especially, I mean, that really wraps around to sort of even beyond just the base level of, oh, here's a new way of developing players and developing prospects that is having this major impact of, okay, you know, as just someone who purely cares about baseball, this is fascinating. As someone who cares about the Mariners, how can this possibly translate to make, you know, to have the team and to have players in the organization get the most out of their careers and their skill set? So, you know, it's very interesting.
Yeah, I found it very odd, to say the least. You know, like, this is the direction baseball's going to, like, oh, the Mariners are going to break with a rotation that they did. And I was just like, I was talking to Brandon Mikulowski about that on Twitter.
Yeah.
And Mark from the USS Mariner.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this, like, the plan is really to go, like, to start with, like, Wade LeBlanc and these guys. Like, this is it. Like there's three guys that average 88 in this rotation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's the, and when, like, you meet, like, look across the street, like, the Astros have just, like, infinite fireballers. Then the Indians have four guys that struck out 200, you know, batters. Right, the Mets suck, but you know, like, at least, you know, like, the direction that the game is going is like, are you like, you have to have a t- like, I don't know, it just seemed very strange that that was the direction that they're gonna go, you know?
Yeah, like the bullpen made sense, at least, you know. Yeah, I mean, exactly. Other than whatever the hell that Nick Vincent does, there's spin rate, and then there's like, however he just avoids bats, I don't know, but like, yeah, it was definitely a choice, and somehow it ended up being that, you know, the offense was still the biggest issue.
Right, of course. Yeah, Kyle Seager's gonna, you know, in a terrible season, which is, you know, and actually, I think for Mariners fans, you know, it's a big collapse, but I think, you know, realistically, he's still a pretty valuable player.
Sure.
Yeah. I just realized that. Yeah, it's tough. Yeah, no, it's interesting to see that the starting rotation kind of went the way it did. But it's, yeah, the game is just evolving in such a, so fast that it's tremendous to watch, honestly. It's amazing how hard everyone throws now, and the fact that hitters hit it. So then you have to be different. Like, you have to, like, 10 years ago, Dan Altavilla would like never, ever, ever get hit. You know, like, that would just not happen, right? And so today it's like, well, actually he has to learn how to pitch a little bit. You know, he throws in the upper 90s. You know, and it's just an interesting game how fast it changed. And so I think it's going to be really cool going forward.
Well, I think we're going to wrap up here. We're running up on about an hour and a half. I have maybe one more quick question that's just curiosity about your baseball perspective here. And I think then we can let you go. Thank you very much for being so generous. But especially with, you know, so how much velocity that we're seeing in the game and how strong and fast and just generally, like, athletically better everyone is getting.
Freakish. I was writing up, I'm doing the Orioles comments for the Baseball Perspective.
Oh, that's right. How did you get that, by the way? You they saw the Mariners person and said, oh, you'll be able to handle writing.
Yeah,
the Orioles.
I think basically, like, who can we use as, like, an innings eater? I think I'm an innings eater for Baseball Perspectives. It's a fair way to put it.
Long reliever.
But, you know, I mean, I'm looking at these guys, and it's like, Michael Givens throws 100, Miguel Castro throws 100. Like, they have tons of guys who throw triple digits just, like, hanging out in their system. It's not, like, they're not unicorns anymore. There are so many guys who throw triple digits.
So I guess I was curious, do you think that there are going to be changes in the way that the game, you know, I mean, like, we saw, you know, like, when they lowered the mound after all the pitch, after the, you know, ERA has dropped, you know, so much. I mean, do you think there is going to be a breaking point at which baseball itself changes in a significant way to address just, I mean, you know, like, defensively, there's, you know, I'm in support of shifting because I think it's strategy. Why would you ever legislate out strategy? But I do think, you know, every defensive player is probably faster by a significant margin than the average player in, you know, the 70s or the 80s, just because you have so much more athleticism. You know, do you think that there will be changes, or do you have changes that you might want to see in the game now that players are getting so much more athletically talented?
I think it's interesting. You know, the shift, I'm obviously pro shift, but then I heard someone actually made a decent argument, not against it, but like a theoretical. They're just like, you ban having five people in the key for 10 seconds in basketball. Like, that's
offensive. That's fair.
And so I said, oh, yeah. I still think shifting should be fine. There's kind of two problems, or two competing issues with this. One, like, pitchers are weird, so they'll try anything new to get better. And, like, the pitchers also kind of dictate the action. So as a result, like, they're always going to be the ones that try different things, I think. And like, gain velocity and add new pitches and things like that. So by nature, hitting is a reactive thing. So hitters are not going to go try to, like, become a, you know, to use the pejorative, like, a launch angle hitter. Like, Justin Turner reinventing himself only happens because the game dictates he should, you know. And he's one of just a very few people that have really changed who they are. So hitting is always going to be behind pitching as a result of that.
Sure.
So that's the one kind of interesting thing. So my first reaction is to be like, let's wait to see if hitters, like, change how they train, because it's going to require retraining of skills. It's going to require true like vision tracking, like different types of hitting, like weighted bats, maybe developing different like strategies at hitting, and just like also let the current crop of minor league hitters who are hitting off of people throwing 100, let them get to the big leagues, because with the Braves, you'll see people like Albies, Acuna, whatever, they're turning around 100 mile an hour pitching. And in fact, a friend of mine, I have a couple friends on the Braves, and one of them just said to Albies, hit like a bomb, and then Acuna hit a bomb off of a dude throwing 100, off the Rays opener, I think, who was throwing 100. And he said, like, you know, like, how did you hit up, you know, was 100, is it coming in pretty good? And Albies is like, it's pretty flat. And my friend is just like, what? Like, my friend is like an up and down AAA guy, and he's like, what? What do you mean it's flat? And he's like, Albies is like, I don't know, it's not that tough to hit. And he's like, oh yeah, all right, this guy's pretty good at hitting. But then also then he thinks about it, he's like, you know, when I came up through the minors, it was not that common. You know, most guys are throwing 90, 91, 93. Those were the best pitchers, you know, and now everyone throws 97. So to get to the big leagues, by definition, you must have hit enough of that to get there. So to me, like, let's let the Acunas, let's let the Albies kind of get up to the big leagues. Let's get the Eloy Jimenezes, you know, and then Vlad Juniors, you know, in 2030 or whenever they're going to call them up. let's let those guys get up there, right? And then let's see if that balances the equation. But then I've had a conversation with another friend who's a big league pitcher, and he's kind of at the end of his career. And I'm telling him this stuff, and he's kind of planning on what he's going to do next with his career. Like, does he want to work in baseball still? He's been in the game a long time. And he's like, you know, he's like, no, I don't agree, man. He's like, I don't agree. Yeah, the hitters are hitting 100, and I get that. He's like, there's going to be a period of time. He's like, once like a team hires you, or like your stuff becomes more successful, he's like, everyone should be watching Trevor going from a 5 ERA pitcher to a Cy Young winner if he doesn't get hit by a ball, you know, developing primarily just a little bit better command and a slider. He's like, people should be watching Walker Buehler switch immediately in the middle of the year to a much better slider and start punching tickets, right? Like, he's like, people should see that. People should see your work with Adam Ottavino, right? Like, Ottavino goes from walking the house to not walking people and setting a reliever record. He's like, the problem is like, that is new. He's like, now? He's like, but it won't be in 4 years. He's like, some team will have hired you, or like enough people will acquire that knowledge. And he's like, hitters will be set back so far that they're not going to have a chance. And I hadn't really ever thought of it that way until he brought it up. And I'm not sure that I agree with him, but I'm not sure that I disagree either. I think how pitchers primarily hit hitters' barrels today, like they are just like dumb. Like, all the advanced scouting that is going on right now, the vast majority of the scouting reports and how to pitch to hitters are based on pseudoscience and not based on actual information on how to get hitters out. And so once improvements are made there and improvements are made on how to deploy their stuff, my friend could very well be right. Like, there may come a time when the hitters have literally no chance, or they've been outpaced so far that, like, it will take too long for them to catch up.
Yeah.
And so then we will have to make a change. And what that change will be is actually, I'm not quite sure what it will be, because people have proposed moving the mound backwards, like further, like to 62 feet. But I promise that will actually make the problem significantly worse, because you can demo this by like just playing catch with someone from 40 feet. And if you throw like sliders, like they don't break. But if you play catch with someone from 70 feet away, all of a sudden they have the nastiest breaking ball.
Yep.
Because it has more time to travel, more Magnus effect causes the ball to break. And so what's causing the problems in the game are not velocity like people think, though that is certainly not helping, right? It's velocity plus like breaking balls. Right, yeah, exactly. So that's going to be the issue. Like, the velocity, I think, will be solved by the current crop of hitters coming up through the minor leagues, I think. At least let's find out.
Yeah.
But pitch design and movement and like ultra precision of like getting people out, that might be really tough to solve. So, but I don't know how you solve that. So I think it'll be really interesting. You know, baseball will adapt, I think. And so let's see where we're at. Let's revisit this conversation in 5 years and see where we're at.
We'll have you back on.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you absolutely. Go. Maybe not quite that time lag. Thank you so much though for taking time out of your day and chatting with us. That was again Kyle Bodie. Kyle, where can people find you on the interwebs if they would like to hear more from you?
They can go to drivelinebaseball.com, the website, and then our Instagram is drivelinebaseball, and then I'm on Twitter at drivelinebases. And so if you want to find a family, fun, totally no swearing experience, then I'm your guy.
Nice. that
I'm the guy.
Is,
I'm the guy to follow.
That is inaccurate. Do not allow your
10-year-old to. That is a lie. That. That's true.
But I will say,
unless
I,
unless the 10-year-old's really cool.
Yeah.
That'd I will fun. Say that drivelinebaseball.com has been really useful when I was trying to learn about some things like pitch tunneling and some other concepts like that. There's a really helpful library there. So
yeah, I mean, Kate, obviously you'd have a somewhat limited baseball playing background.
And, yes,
like,
yes.
I played all through college, but like this is still stuff that is very accessible, very interesting, very valuable, and like no matter really what your background in the sport. So that is something worth checking out.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks again, and thanks to all of you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.